Chapter 11. The traffic jam was horrendous even by Washington standards. Paul Trout had been sitting behind the steering wheel of his Humvee, staring with glazed eyes at the wall-to-wall carpet of cars clogging Pennsylvania Avenue, when he turned suddenly to Gamay and said, "My gills are starting to close up." Gamay rolled her eyes in the way of a wife long used to her husband's eccentricities. She knew what was coming. Paul's family said only half-jokingly that if a Trout stayed away from his ancestral home for too long, he would start gasping for breath like a fish out of water. Therefore, she wasn't surprised when he made an illegal U-turn, displaying the contempt for rules of the road that seem born into Massachusetts drivers. While Paul drove as if he were on Desert Storm maneuvers, she used her cell phone to call the airlines for reservations and to let their NUMA office know they would be away for a few days. They whirled through their Georgetown townhouse like twin tornadoes, packed their overnight bags, and dashed to the airport. Less than 2 hours after their shuttle flight landed in Boston, they were on Cape Cod, strolling along Water Street in the village of Woods Hole, where Trout had been born and raised. Woods Hole's main thoroughfare is about a quarter of a mile long, squeezed between a salt pond and harbor, and bordered on both sides by buildings that house organizations devoted to marine and environmental science. The most conspicuous of these is the world-renowned Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Nearby, in a vintage brick and granite edifice, is the Marine Biological Laboratory, whose research programs and library of nearly 200,000 volumes attract scholars from around the globe. Within walking distance of MBL is the National Marine Fisheries Aquarium. On the outskirts of the village are the U.S. Geological Survey and dozens of sea education institutions and private companies that produce the high-tech underwater gadgets used by ocean scientists the world over. A breeze was coming off the harbor from the direction of the Elizabeth Islands. Trout paused on the tiny drawbridge that separates Eel Pond and Great Harbor, and he filled his lungs with salty air, thinking that there must be some truth to the gill-closing story. He could actually breathe again. Trout was the son of a local fisherman and his wife, and his family still owned the low-slung Cape Cod cottage where he had been raised. His intellectual home was the Oceanographic Institution. As a boy, he used to run errands for some of the scientists who worked at the institution, and it was at their encouragement that he had specialized in deep ocean geology, a move that would bring him eventually to NUMA and its special assignments team. Within hours of their arrival, Paul had checked on his house, touched base with several relatives, and stopped off for lunch with Gamay at a local watering hole, where he knew everyone at the bar. Then he began to make the rounds. He was visiting the institution's deep submergence lab where an old colleague was bringing him up to date on the latest in autonomous underwater vehicles when the phone rang. "It's for you," his colleague said, handing Trout the phone. A voice boomed on the line. "Hello, Trout. This is Sam Osborne. Heard down at the post office that you were back in town. How are you and your lovely wife?" Osborne was a phycologist, one of the world's foremost experts in the science of algology, or the study of algae. After years of teaching, he still talked in a range that was 2 or 3 decibels above that of a normal human being. Trout didn't bother asking how Osborne had tracked him down. It was impossible to keep anything secret in a village the size of Woods Hole. "We're fine, thank you. Nice of you to give me a call, Dr. Osborne." Osborne cleared his throat. Well, actually, I wasn't calling you. I wanted to speak to your wife." Trout smiled. "I don't blame you for that. Gamay is much prettier than I am." He handed the phone to his wife. Gamay Morgan Trout was an attractive woman, not gorgeous or overly sexy, but appealing to most men. She had a flashing smile with a slight gap in her upper teeth, like the model actress Lauren Hutton. She was tall, 5'10" and 135 pounds, slim for her height. Her hair, which was long and generally worn swirled, was dark red, the reason her father, a wine connoisseur, had named her after the grape of Beaujolais. More open and vivacious than her husband, she worked well with men, a talent that went back to her tomboy days in Wisconsin. Her father was a successful developer who had encouraged her to compete with men, teaching her to sail and shoot skeet. She was an expert diver and marksman. Gamay listened for a moment and then said, "We'll be right over." Hanging up, she said, "Dr. Osborne has asked us to come by the MBL. He says it's urgent." "Everything is urgent to Sam," Paul said. "Now, now, you needn't be snide just because he wanted to talk to me." "I don't have a snide bone in my body," Paul said, linking arms with Gamay. He bid goodbye to his colleague in the submergence lab, and they set off along Water Street. A few minutes later, they were climbing the wide stone steps at the Lilly Research Building, where they went through an arched doorway into a quiet lobby. Dr. Osborne was waiting for them just inside. He pumped Paul's hand and embraced Gamay, whom he'd had as a student when she was studying marine biology at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography in California. Osborne was in his mid-50s, and his balding, curly white hair seemed to be slipping off the back of his skull. He had a big bone physique and large workman's hands that looked more suitable for handling a pickaxe than the delicate strands of marine vegetation that were his specialty. "Thanks for coming over," he said. "I hope that this is no imposition."
"None at all," Gamay said sweetly. "Always a pleasure to see you."
"You may not think so when you hear what I have to tell you," Osborne said with an enigmatic smile. Without further explanation, he led them to his office. Although the MBL was known all over the world for its research facilities and library, the Lilly Building Lab was an unpresumptuous place. Exposed pipes ran along the ceilings. The doors lining the hallways were of dark wood with pebbled glass panels, and in general, it looked exactly like what it was, a venerable old lab building. Osborne ushered the Trouts into his office. Gamay had remembered Osborne as fanatically neat and organized, bordering on the anal, and she saw that he hadn't changed. Where many professors of his stature surrounded themselves with piles of paper and reports, his office consisted of a computer table and chair and a couple of folding chairs for visitors. His only luxury was a tea maker, which he had picked up in Japan. He poured 3 cups of green tea, and after a brief exchange of pleasantries, he said, "Pardon me for being so brusque, but time is short, so I'll get right to the point." He leaned back in his chair, tented his fingers, and said to Gamay, "As a marine biologist, you're acquainted with Caulerpa taxifolia?" Gamay had received a degree in marine archaeology from the University of North Carolina before changing her field of interest and enrolling at Scripps, where she'd attained a doctorate in marine biology. Gamay smiled inwardly as she remembered being a student in Osborne's class. He typically asked questions in the form of a statement. "Caulerpa is an alga that's native to the tropics, although it's often seen in home aquariums."
"Correct. And you know that the cold water strain that thrives so well in aquaria has become a major problem in certain coastal areas."
Gamay nodded.
"Killer seaweed.
It's destroyed large expanses of the seabed in the Mediterranean and has spread to other places as well. It's a strain of a tropical alga. Tropical algae don't normally live in cold water, but this strain has adapted. It could spread anywhere in the world." Osborne turned to Paul.
"The weed we're talking about was inadvertently released into the water beneath the Oceanographic Museum of Monaco in 1984. Since then, it has spread to 30,000 hectares in the coastal flora off 6 Mediterranean countries, and it's a problem off Australia and San Diego. It spreads like wildfire. The problem goes beyond speed. The Caulerpa colonies are extremely invasive. The weed spreads out with runners and forms a dense green carpet that crowds out other flora and fauna, depriving plants and animals of sunlight and oxygen. Its presence destroys the base of the marine food web, damages native species with devastating consequences for ecosystems.
Isn't there any way to fight this stuff?
In San Diego, they've had some success using tarpaulins to quarantine patches of weed while pumping chlorine into the water and the mud that anchors the plants. This technique would be useless with a widespread infestation. There has been an effort to educate aquarium dealers who sell Caulerpa or deal in rocks that might be contaminated with organisms."
"No natural enemies," Trout said. "Its defense mechanisms are amazingly complex. The weed contains toxins that deter herbivores. It does not die back in winter."
"Sounds like a real monster," Trout said.
"Oh, it is. It is. A tiny fragment can start a new colony,
Its only weakness is that it can't reproduce sexually like its wild relatives. But think what might happen if it were to disperse eggs over long distances.
Not a pleasant thought, Gamay said. It could become unstoppable.
Osborne turned to Paul. As an ocean geologist, you're familiar with the area of the Lost City? Trout was glad to get out of the realm of biology and into his area of expertise. It's an area of hydrothermal vents along the Atlantic Massif. The material spewing from the sea bottom has built up tall mineral towers that resemble skyscrapers, hence the name. I've read the research on it. Fascinating stuff. I'd like to get out there sometime.
You may soon get your chance, Osborne said.
Paul and Gamay exchanged puzzled glances. Osborne chuckled, noting their befuddled expressions.
Perhaps you'd better come with me, he said.
They left the office and after several twists and turns found themselves in a small laboratory. Osborne went over to a padlocked metal storage cabinet. He unlocked the door with a key hung from his belt and extracted a cylindrical glass vial about 12 inches tall and 6 inches in diameter. The top was sealed tight. He placed the vial on the table under a lab light. The container seemed to be filled from top to bottom with a thick, grayish-green substance. Gamay leaned forward to examine the contents and said, "What is this gunk?"
"Before I answer your question, let me give you a little background. A few months ago, MBL participated in a joint expedition to the Lost City with the Woods Hole Oceanographic. The area is rife with unusual microbes and the substances they produce.
The combinations of heat and chemicals have been compared to the conditions that prevailed when life began on Earth," Gamay said.
Osborne nodded.
"On that expedition, the submersible Alvin brought up samples of seaweed. This is a dead sample of what you're looking at."
"The stem and leaf looks vaguely like Caulerpa, but different somehow," Gamay said.
"Very good. The genus has more than 70 Caulerpa species, including those you find in pet shops. Invasive behavior had been documented in 5 of those, although few of the species are well studied. This is a totally unknown species. I've named it Caulerpa gorgonosa."
"Gorgonweed. I like it."
"You won't like it after you've become as well acquainted with this infernal freak as I have. Scientifically speaking, we're looking at a mutant strain of Caulerpa. Unlike its cousins, though, this species can reproduce sexually."
"If that's true, this gorgonweed can spread its eggs over long distances. That could be a serious matter."
"It already is. Gorgonweed is intermingled with taxifolia and is now displacing that weed. It has shown up in the Azores, and we're seeing samples along the coast of Spain. Its growth rate is nothing short of phenomenal. There has been a burst of growth that is extraordinary. Great patches of weed are floating in the Atlantic. Soon they will join in a single mass."
Paul let out a low whistle. "It could take over the entire ocean at that rate."
"That's not the worst of it. Taxifolia creates a smothering carpet of alga. Like the Medusa whose gaze could turn men into stone, gorgonweed becomes a thick, hard biomass. Nothing can exist where it is present."
Gamay gazed at the vial with the horror brought on by her knowledge of the world's oceans.
"You're basically talking about the world's oceans solidifying."
"I can't even comprehend a worst-case scenario, but I do know this. Within a short time, gorgonweed could spread along temperate coasts and cause irreparable ecological damage," Osborne said, his voice an uncharacteristic whisper.
"It would affect the weather, possibly causing famine. It could bring ocean commerce to a stop. Nations that depend on ocean protein could go hungry. There would be political disruptions around the world as the haves and the have-nots fight over food."
"Who else knows about this?" Paul said. "Ships have reported the weed as a nuisance, but outside of this room, only a few trusted colleagues in this and other countries are aware of the gravity of the situation."
"Shouldn't people know about the threat so they can get together to fight it?" Gamay said.
"Absolutely. But I didn't want to sow seeds of panic until my research was complete. I was in the process of preparing a report which I will submit next week to the pertinent organizations, such as NUMA and the UN.
Is there any chance you could do it sooner? Gimay said.
Oh, yes, but here's the problem.
When the issue is biological control, there is often a tug of war between eradication interests and scientific study. The eradicators, understandably, want to attack the problem quickly, with every weapon at their command. If this news gets out, research will be quarantined for fear their work will spread the weed. He glanced at the vial. This creature is not some sort of ocean-born crabgrass. I'm convinced we can successfully deal with it once we have more weapons at our disposal. Unless we know exactly what we're dealing with, no eradication method will work.
How can NUMA help? Gimay said.
Another Lost City expedition is underway. The oceanographic research vessel Atlantis will be on site this week with the Alvin. They will attempt to explore the area of the sea where the weed appears to have mutated. Once we determine the conditions that led to this aberration, we can work to defeat it. I've been trying to figure out how I can finish my work here and go on the expedition. When I heard you two were in town, I took it as a sign from the gods. You bring the perfect blend of expertise. Would you consider joining the expedition in my stead? It would only be a few days.
Of course. We'd have to get permission from our superiors at NUMA, but that will present no problem.
I can trust you to be discreet. Once we have samples in hand, I will release my report simultaneously with my colleagues worldwide. Where is the Atlantis now? Paul said.
Returning from an unrelated mission. It is stopping in the Azores tomorrow to refuel. You can join the ship there.
It's doable, Paul said. We can be back in Washington tonight and on our way in the morning.
He glanced at the vial.
We're going to have a real problem if that thing in there gets out of the bottle.
Gimay had been staring at the greenish blob.
The genie is already out of the bottle, I'm afraid.
We're going to have to figure out how to get it back in.